Welcome to this special Day One Conversation. With us today is Diana Butler Bass, the author of 8 books on American Protestantism, including Christianity for the Rest of Us and A People's History of Christianity. Her latest book, just out, is Christianity After Religion, The End of Church and the Birth of a New Spiritual Awakening. Diana earned her PhD in church history from Duke University and has served on the faculty at the University of California at Santa Barbara, Rhodes College, and Virginia Theological Seminary. She is a popular speaker at churches, retreats, and conferences across the country. Diana, thanks for talking with us.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be with you, Peter.
In your new book, Christianity After Religion, you start with a premise that all of us in the mainline church are struggling to understand and respond to. Religious affiliation continues to fall across Christian denominations. Recently, a YouTube video by a young person went viral with 17 million views. It's called Why I Hate Religion But Love Jesus. But what are some of the factors that have caused this spiral of involvement in organized religion?
The question about decline and erosion is a really important one in the first decade of the 21st century. We came into the new millennium expecting, I think, a sort of religious or spiritual revival. If we can think back to the late 90s, so much interest in angels, religion books were bestsellers. Even mainline churches in the late 90s had slowed, in some cases steadied or reversed declines that had happened in terms of membership over the previous 30 years. But as we came into this first decade of the millennium, it was like the bottom fell out. And it was not just the bottom of mainline churches. It is literally every religious tradition is suffering right now in terms of membership decline. So the video that the young person produced on YouTube, that young person, I don't know what their affiliation is, but I'm betting they're not a Presbyterian. I'm betting they might have even grown up Baptist or evangelical, because those traditions are suffering just as much as the old mainline has. And so the second part of your question about, well, what caused it? I think that in the very first few years, this decade, we experienced 4 great shocks and then a crisis. And the 4 great shocks were 2001, with September 11th, where religion became associated with violence in the minds of not just Americans, but many, many, many people around the world. 6 months after the towers collapsed in that act of terrorism, we kind of forget this. We might have still been a little bit in shock because of September 11th. But it was in March of 2002 that the Boston Globe did the story about the Roman Catholic 5 mm-hmm. Roman Catholic priests mm-hmm. in Boston that had abused children in their care. And it was from that set of stories that the Roman Catholic Church was plunged into what I think is the greatest crisis that it's faced in the last 700 years. Some people say, oh, the Protestant Reformation 500 years ago was its great crisis. But I think that it's biggest crisis was really when they had 3 popes in the 1300s, and not many people remember that. You know, it was a pretty long time ago. So we had then in popular imagination religion associated with abuse. And 2003, the Episcopal Church consecrated Gene Robinson as the first out gay bishop in any global Christian tradition. And I think that what that did was my personal opinion is the Episcopal Church did the right thing, but in some senses, we might have done it in the wrong way. And it began to unpack some really sort of nasty partisan divides in mainline churches. And we looked completely uncivil, like we didn't know what we were doing. We were brawling in public. And so religion becomes associated with meanness and incivility. Not quite as bad as terrorism and abuse, but pretty bad. Mm-hmm. And then the 4th shock was in 2004, when evangelicals really succeeded in a 30-year sort of quest in terms of the moral majority in gaining ultimate political power. And every political sort of pundit and commentator I know says that evangelicals basically delivered the White House to George W. Bush in his second term. And so in a very real sense, they won. They had complete political victory. And in doing that, that might sound like a success, but it was actually a failure. They won the battle, but they lost the war. Because what they didn't notice is that despite their political success and that they had all the money and power they could ever ask for, their children were leaving their churches. And the younger evangelicals have rejected the politics of their parents, and they've also rejected the identification of Christianity with single-party politics. Mm-hmm. And they began leaving in droves. And so those are the four shocks: terrorism, religion associated with violence, the Catholic abuse scandal, religion associated with abuse, the mainline crisis over the inclusion, the rightful inclusion of gay and lesbian folks in the churches, which created an atmosphere of incivility and lack of trust. And then the third thing was, I call it evangelical Constantinianism, where where you win the battle, but you essentially lose the war, or you win the world and you lose your soul. Mm. It was that all that happened in the first 4 years of the 21st century, and then the recession hit. Mm-hmm. And so once the financial crisis was the final blow to an already terribly grim picture for religious life in the United States. And the statistics throughout the whole decade have been spiraling downward, and it's very difficult to see any kind of recovery.
And speaking of the recession and the economy, historically, I've been led to believe that in bad economies, people have turned to churches and other places of worship for spiritual support and so forth. But the opposite seems to be happening in this down economy. Why do you think?
That's exactly right, is that you would assume that if people were hurting, they would go to church. I had wondered about that question myself when I was writing this book, and I remembered an article that I read about the Great Depression. It was an article that was written several decades ago by Robert Handy, wonderful, venerated professor of church history in the middle part of the 20th century. And he pointed out that during the Great Depression, people did not go to church, that it was a great economic depression and it was a great religious depression. And I realized that many of the sort of patterns that he pointed out about the Great Depression were actually true about what's happening now. I think that one of the factors is that middle-class people, who are especially good churchgoers, when they lose their job or when they lose their homes or when they're fearful about the future, they're so used to being the people who help the poor that all of a sudden when they find that they are the poor— there's a level of shame and fear that goes with that that I think that they don't really want to share in that vulnerable state. You would think they'd go to church to be with their friends, but instead they sort of flee church and go live in that vulnerability all by themselves. And so that happened during the Great Depression. During the Depression, there was one sort of religious group that did grow, and that was the sort of the new kinds of small but growing Pentecostal churches. They did pick up members at that time, and some of the small fundamentalist churches as well. And I suspect that was because those churches had some sort of unique ability to embrace the poor. And there's been a lot of history books written about that in the last few decades, that early fundamentalism and early Pentecostalism really did serve the needs of people who were on the margins and the outcast. So what that makes me wonder is, you know, are there sort of new religious movements that are on the edges of society? Not that the traditional churches are not gaining during this time of loss. Are there any other places in the culture where there are gains that we can look to and say, hey, that might be where people are going? Those groups in some ways are meeting people's deepest emotional needs at a difficult time.
And one of the phenomena that is happening now, as you have pointed out in your book, is that more people are identifying as spiritual but not religious. interest in spirituality, however defined, is on the rise. So for various reasons, people are turning away from church, organized religion, but engaging in spirituality in other ways. What are the most common ways that people are expressing that spirituality these days?
There's sort of two ways that people self-describe that point mm-hmm. towards what I call this this longing for spiritual connection. There's the 30% of the population that calls themselves spiritual but not religious. And they've been with us for a while now. We've been tracking their growth and their cultural sort of power over the last 30 years. We began to talk in that language in the middle part of the 80s. But there's a second group that has my attention sort of riveted on them, and that is the 48% of Americans that say they're spiritual and religious. And I think that, you know, my work really focuses on that spiritual and religious mm-hmm. group. I'm very interested in the people who blend traditions and are trying to, in some way, carry on some level of what they love out of religion, but they're doing it in new contexts. So that's really one of the things that I explore in the book. And I think that it's very helpful to understand that when people talk about being spiritual, whether it's spiritual and not religious or spiritual mm-hmm. and religious, what they're elevating is the experience of faith. And that is, in some way, shape, or form, the institution of religion, those conventional forms and structures of religion, have failed mm-hmm. them personally, or maybe even more globally in terms of their communities, but that they're still longing for some way of connecting their life to God, to understanding their own lives at a deeper level, connecting with themselves inwardly and connecting with their neighbors. And so sometimes people talk about spirituality being about individualism, but all of the studies about when people talk about spirituality, they're not about studies of isolation. They're about mm-hmm. people seeking new connections, which I find to be a tremendously hopeful thing about that language.
Now, more broadly, in your book, you say that we are in the midst of another great awakening. If you could give us a brief historical context of the great awakenings in American history.
It really ties in very much to the last question. Awakenings are not revivals. Mm-hmm. And there's often a confusion between those two words in sort of popular definitions. Revivals are sort of individual, isolated mm-hmm. events. You know, you can do it once a year, twice a year, four times a year. The Billy Graham revival can happen whenever. And that revivals are where individuals go in order to sort of stir up their own hearts and their lives get changed, just individual people. Awakenings are times of cultural reorientation where the whole darn thing falls apart and needs to be put back together in a different kind of way. And most people who teach American religious history and even cultural history agree that there have been three such dramatic times of political, cultural, and religious reorientation in American history. One would have been from 1730 to 1770, and historians are very creative people, so they call that the First Great Awakening. I always wonder,
makes sense.
Yeah, why couldn't they call it something more imaginative? But anyway, that was the First Great Awakening, in which we moved from being a European-based society to a new democratic, revolutionary culture. The Second Great Awakening happened actually fairly quickly on the heels of the First Great Awakening. The creatively named Second Great Awakening was from about 1800 to 1840. And that's the time in which Americans sort of really embraced democratic forms of religion mm-hmm. and also democratic forms of social change. And we became what Martin Marty once dubbed the benevolent empire. Mm. And all of America's great 19th century social reform movements were founded at that time. The Third Great Awakening followed the Civil War, or we're sitting here in Atlanta, so I suppose I should call it that late unpleasantness. the Third Great Awakening was a switch in American and in religious self-understanding of being sort of a a collection of individual states and a collection of individual churches to having a real national outlook.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's when our national denominations were founded, and that our churches became sort of institutionalized in the way that we currently have them. That was an advance. That was a real change. That was a better way of doing business between 1890 and roughly 1930.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also the period in which liberal theology was birthed. And it was that kind of liberal, nationalistic, even kind of a sort of a liberal nationalistic imperialism that mm-hmm. was the new identity of the United States at that point in time. So those three awakenings, very powerful, and you can really see how the United States and its religious mm-hmm. practice was different before the awakening began, and then after the awakening came to some sort of logical kinds of conclusion. In a 40-year period, there would be a tremendous change. And what's happening now, of course, is that there are a lot of people who have suggested we're in a period of a fourth great awakening. Mm-hmm. And I take that idea and I try to unpack it and explore where that awakening might be and what that awakening is about.
And in doing so, you argue that traditional Christianity has focused on three prescriptions. How do you describe those?
Up until this point in American religious history, we have tended to emphasize what I call three questions.
Mm-hmm.
What do we believe? How do we do it? That is, you know, how do you practice being how do you engage being a Presbyterian or Catholic or whatever? And then finally, who am I? And that question is answered by saying, I am an Episcopalian, I am a Jew, whatever your answer would be. That is the way religious life in America was organized through most of the 20th century.
And is that a chronological, you go through those three stages?
Yeah, usually you go through that. You think about when you get in a discussion with somebody about religion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, oftentimes someone will start with that first question, you know, mm-hmm. what do you believe? And it was assumed for a long time that if you knew what you believed, you would act a particular way, and then you would join that particular church.
Mm-hmm.
And so Western belief started in the what do I believe question, or Western faith started in the what do I believe question. What I actually think is changing in this thing that we can call the Fourth Great Awakening is that I think that the questions have changed. I think the what do I believe question has actually shifted to how do I believe. It's moved off of an information question to a question of experience. How do I experience God? How do I be a Christian and embrace the findings of science? How do I say the creed and have it mean something authentically in my life? Belief questions have shifted away from what to how. The second set of questions about action have shifted from how do I do that, techniques and rules, mm-hmm. towards practices. And so instead of asking, how do I do something, the first question that almost all of my friends ask is, what am I going to do? And you think about the power of that question in our culture. Everyone from a middle schoolers to retirees are asking the question of vocation, what do I do? And then the third question has shifted from who am I, that is, I am someone or I am a member of this club, toward whose am I?
Mm.
And that is, who's next to me? Who am I with? Who are my friends? Who's my life connected with? So the questions have shifted, but I also think the order of the questions has reversed. So in the 20th century, you would start with belief,
mm-hmm.
move to practice or move to action, and then move to membership. What's happening now is that people actually begin with their friends and with their communities. And it's from that place of friendship and community that people move up to action, the practices that make their lives meaningful. And then finally, people can engage in those questions of how this makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, is we're changing the questions and reversing the order. And when we do that, we're going to come out on the other side of this with a religious life in the United States that's profoundly different than the way that our grandparents experienced religious life.
So your point is that this bottom-up approach represents a more authentic approach to the Jesus mission and message?
I think it is much closer to the biblical stories. One of the things that I have fun with in the new book, and people I don't think typically think of me as a writer this way, is I actually look at the way in which faith was formed in the New Testament with the disciples and Jesus. And, you know, Jesus starts with, follow me. He doesn't walk by a lake and say to a bunch of guys, hey, do you believe in an inerrant Bible? Or can you recite the Nicene Creed? And if you can, well, then come this way and I've got 40 points of how you should live your life, or, you know, 40 days to a better way of living. He says, follow me. So there's the relational communal call. And it's out of that community that they begin to do stuff together. And Jesus introduces them to practices of healing, practices that are going to be the things that reveal the kingdom, practices of giving, charity, opening their hearts, generosity, hospitality. And then comes, and I love it because it does actually come in Scripture, who do you say I am? Mm. That's the belief question that comes after the feeding of the 5,000, after they've seen this amazing act of hospitality. And then Peter says, oh, you are the Messiah. So belief comes out of community, practice, and then you can answer the question of how this works out in the world.
Let me ask kind of a side question. You point out that in 2009, 48% of Americans claimed they had a mystical experience or encounter with the divine, which is an increase of more than 25% since the early 1960s. And that seems surprising in this high-tech multimedia world. How are people experiencing these spiritual encounters now? And does technology have any part of it?
Technology forms such an important part of our lives. Technology is both the backdrop of our lives, and it's also the major tool of our lives. And I think one of the things that we all know about technology is that there's a level of it that is somewhat sterile. I mean, the deepest spiritual promises of technology are for connection and community, but it's often not experienced that way. Technology sort of opens up a sort of a yawning for new ways of connecting with meaning. And I think that the very act of holding a computer creates the environment in which we want to walk out into nature and discover a different part of ourselves. And sometimes that becomes that mystical experience where we walk out the door and we say, oh my gosh, you know, look at this. This is this sunset. God is here. Something else is here. Something transcendent is here. Something that I'm not getting in my work life or my cubicle or even online with my friends where I do have community, but it's not quite this. And it's really an amazing statistic that one out of every two Americans says that they've had a mystical experience of some sort that has created a deeper spiritual life. I don't know that they're telling their other friends in the Presbyterian or the Lutheran church that, but they say that they've had these things.
Mm-hmm. You know, the spiritual but not religious people have been accused of being individualistic. You touched on this a little earlier, but I think you're seeing a more real-life community involvement with these folks. How are people experiencing community who are in this new awakening?
Oftentimes people who are heavily invested in church and religious structures make the accusation towards people who are more interested in spirituality,
right,
that it's about individualism. But I'm not convinced, because individualism is just a problem across American culture. And certainly people who say they're spiritual but not religious, I'm sure there's a whole big number of them who are individualistic. But I have been in any number of church meetings in my life where somebody stands up and says, if you don't do it my way, I'm going to take my pledge and leave this church. Hmm. And if that ruins this congregation, well, I don't care. That's one of the rawest acts of individualism I can think of. Mm-hmm. if you just put a bunch of people in a church, it does not make them a community. Oftentimes, churches foster radical individualism. Right. So I don't think you can say that religion creates community and spirituality creates individualism. And the contrary sort of story is I have a good friend who's a yoga teacher. And one time I was asking her, I said, you know, I've been trying to learn yoga all this time. And she said, well, what did you do? And I said, well, I went out and I bought the mat and I have these DVDs and I've got these cool yoga clothes that I bought at Nordstrom's. And so I tried to like buy yoga, you know, and I also tried to teach myself with the DVD. And I told her that I was really struggling because I couldn't actually look at the TV and see the DVD and do the pose at the same time. And she started laughing at me. And she says, you can't learn yoga by yourself. She said, you need to be in a community. And then she told me, you know, that in her class, she's the mentor and people learn from one another. And that there's a whole tradition and body of things that you have to know in order to do yoga. And the way she described, and she's also, her background is Jewish. She's become a Hindu and she's a yoga teacher. And so she's not a Christian. She hardly, she's gone to some friends' churches once in a while, but she doesn't know anything about churches. But she described the yoga class. It was like an ideal church. And so I thought to myself, you know, that's what some people are longing for. It's not that they're looking for individualism necessarily. You can be spiritual and you can be individualistic. You can be religious and individualistic. But you can also find meaningful community in both sides of that ledger as well. But community takes work and it takes a commitment. And I don't care what you call yourself, you're gonna you can find that in yoga or the Presbyterian Church. If you're looking for it, and if that's where your hunger is, and that's how you're, how you can find new connection with God and with others.
Now, Diana, some may not like your subhead to the book, Christianity After Religion, The End of Church and the Birth of a New Spiritual Awakening, The End of Church. People react to that. So what would you say to church leaders, their members, about how they can respond to this new reality in a positive way?
Oh, we actually had quite an argument at the publisher about that subtitle. And it was really hard for me to go there because many people who love my writing love it because it's been about churches and that I've affirmed their congregations and the hope for a church. And so here I come writing a book called The End of Church. I kind of feel a little like Barbara Brown Taylor writing a book, Leaving Church. And what it really means is that this is the end of conventional church. The jig is up for the old way that we used to do it. But when the old way ends, it doesn't mean that everything is gone. It just means that we're going to have to think of new ways of being. And I really am incredibly optimistic that the sort of these spiritual longings that we've been talking about that are on the margins of culture, the way having people flee away from the convention towards other things, in however inchoate and however messy and chaotic that is, that it's in those margins where the longings and the hopes of the future are always found. And that's my real dream, is to finally get people in the mainline traditions that I deeply love and that I have invested so much of my life into encouraging and giving hope to just say, hey, guys, it's really time to go. It's really time to leave Ur and make sure that we're on the journey to the right place. And that's the journey to where God is going to be found in the 21st century. And we're going to take some cool stuff with us in terms of our beautiful liturgies and our amazing theological traditions and the wonder of our ancestors. But there's going to also be some other things we're going to have to leave behind, some things that are just merely customary or conventional. That's just not going to cut it anymore. And we got to go out to where people are longing and embracing new ways of being with God and doing justice in the world, because awakenings always, always, always result in greater social justice, greater equality, and a renewed life politic. At least in the United States, that's what the history of awakenings are. And so that's where I want to be. I don't want to be stuck in a church building when the awakening is happening outside. Mm-hmm. And so if that means we go out into the streets, that's where we need to go.
Now, in researching your book, you did visit a number of strong Christian communities, and we certainly know that there are many thriving churches. Are they doing something right? Have they tapped into this reality, do you think?
The previous book that a lot of people, certainly who will be listening to this program, know best of my work, Christianity for the Rest of Us, that was a study of 50 vital congregations. And looking back now at those churches, I think that those were churches that were actually doing the work that I've just described. They are churches that were engaging spirituality in ways that were incredibly appropriate to their traditions and asking themselves tough questions that were arising in the world around the church, not just, you know, what's going to make us feel better, but instead, what is God calling us to do? And so I think that I wrote a book already sort of unwittingly about how good, amazing congregations can make some of these changes. I think that my imagination has gone a little broader on this project. I don't write nearly as much about specific churches. I do talk about them on the road when I'm engaged in this subject, and I use a few examples like this in the new book. But the new book is really more about questions and sort of stories of encounters that I've had along the way. One of the best examples of, I think, something that can be very provocative and exciting for the future is in Omaha, Nebraska, of all places. There is a wonderful, amazing Jewish synagogue. And I know the rabbi there. Several years ago, he and his congregation had outgrown their building, which was in downtown Omaha, and they bought a piece of property on the edge of the city. And that was really hard for them because there were a congregation who was very involved in doing social justice work in the city. Mm-hmm. And so the rabbi began to ask himself, well, what are we going to do? You know, what is God calling us to do that's the work of justice for the future? And one day he's out to lunch with a friend of his who happened to be the imam of the local mosque. The rabbi was born in Jerusalem. The imam was born in Damascus. They could have never been friends in the Middle East. But here they are both in Omaha. And so they're friends. And so the rabbi tells the imam this whole story about moving. And the imam says, you know, that's really funny. My congregation is having the same problem. He says, who knew there were so many Muslims in Omaha? And so he says, we can't fit in our building. We have to find a place to go. And the rabbi told me they locked eyes and they said, what if we did it together?
Wow.
And the rabbi said, I would love to do that. He said, but I bet you I'm going to get in a lot of trouble with my congregation. And the imam says, me too. And lo and behold, they said that they wanted to do that. And then the next step was, as the rabbi related the story to me, they realized they couldn't do it unless they had a Christian group to do it too. And so they went to the Catholic Archdiocese of Nebraska. I don't know if it's called Omaha or if it's called Nebraska. I don't know my archdiocese that well. But the Catholics turned them down flat. And I was friends with the rabbi. He told me the story. And so he said, oh, do you know any Christians who might want to build a church with a mosque and a synagogue? And I happen to be an Episcopalian. And I said, do I have a group for you? Mm. I said, I can't speak for the Episcopal Diocese of Nebraska, but I would go ask them. And he said, I hadn't thought of that. He says, Anglicans, second best next to Catholics. And so he went to them and they jumped at it like no tomorrow. And so what they have now done is the synagogue is built, the mosque is being built, and there's an Episcopal congregation there. They've also built a community center that all three of the congregations share. And so the Episcopal congregation right now is meeting in the community center, but they're getting ready to build a building as well. And so it's the three buildings in which each religious group celebrates its God in its way. Yet they are completely neighbors, and they share the community building, where they have common meals and they engage in ministries of justice and feeding hungry people and offer lectures and cooperative kinds of prayer and worship experiences where their traditions can meet in the middle. Mm-hmm. And so there in Omaha, Nebraska, the rabbi said to me, he said, you know, he said, I dream of a new world. And he said, I always knew that there could be a new world in America. He said, I always knew the new world would never be born in the old. He said, and we are going to make it together, the three children of Abraham. Mm. And when he said that, excuse me, I get all choked up with this. When he said that the three children of Abraham were going to make this new world, he says, who knew it was in Omaha? You know, and I just thought to myself of John Winthrop and the great, amazing, formative sermon of The City Set Upon a Hill. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, The City Set Upon a Hill is in the plains. Mm. And the future is there. I think that's the great awakening, is somehow we're going to find our way to be completely ourselves and to love our gods and find out that the one God is really the one God. Mm. And it's happening. It's really happening. It's happening in places like Omaha. And Christians have to be in there with our Christian awakening in order to be fully, beautifully, completely engaged ourselves. But the powerful thing about this awakening is it's not just Christian. It's Jewish. It's Islamic. It's Buddhist. It's all of these things. It's all of us pushing towards greater depth, authenticity, experience, and connection that is going to really bring forth the possibility for a different kind of peace between human beings and a different kind of human flourishing. And if we don't do it, the alternate future for planet Earth is not very good. Mm. And so I am going out there like George Whitefield and preaching a new awakening. I hope that my friends can hear.
The book is Christianity After Religion, Diana Butler Bass. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks. I really am glad to be here, and it's a wonderful thing to finally share this project that's exciting me so much.